Welcome to Island Conversations with Sherry Bracken, where we talk about issues facing our Big Island community. Island Conversations, Sunday mornings on KWXX at 6:30 and on B97B93 at 7 a.m. Or listen anytime at kwxx.com. Island Conversations, brought to you by KTA Superstores, where you're someone special every day since 1916. Now, here's your host and producer, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha. Welcome to Island Conversations. Today, we're continuing talking about the Japanese in Hawaii with third-generation coffee farmer Walter Kunitake. His grandparents started farming coffee in Kona around 1910, and we'll ask Walter about the immigrants who moved from plantations to being small farmers, among other things. Walter Kunitake grew up on coffee lands in Kona in a family that valued education. He earned his bachelor's, his master's, and his Ph.D. in business administration. Walter Kunitake is also a CPA, and he taught at the University of Hawaii and at Pennsylvania State University. He was also instrumental in beginning the University of Hawaii's West Hawaii Institution. He's still a Kona coffee farmer, and he and his wife Charlene have Country Samurai Coffee on Ali'i Drive behind Maui Divers Jewelry. He's been very active in the community, among other things, being on the Saddle Road Task Force, which helped bring us our beautiful Cross Island Saddle Road, and now he's part of the effort to bring a regional park to Kona. Plus, he's working on creating a Japanese cultural center in Kona, which I'll ask him about later. Good morning. Aloha, Walter.
Good morning, Sherry. Thank you for having me here.
Well, this is good. And Walter, first I want to mention about your activism. Ingrained in your family, I believe it is. As example, your mother, Kiono Kunitake, who I thought was just an amazing woman. And people may not realize that when the state decided to close down the old Kona airport and make it not an airport anymore, their initial plan was to make it an industrial area. But your mother, Kiono Kunitake, who is this little tiny woman, like 4'5", I think, she had other plans. What was your mom's reaction to the state's plan to make the old Kona airport area an industrial area?
Well, you know, this is an interesting time of my own life when I saw this, as you described, a short Japanese lady right off the farm having this interest in preserving the old airport as a for-the-people open space park. And, you know, I'm watching this journey that my mother went through, and I'm thinking this is a very interesting journey that I will probably experience. So I sat back and I said, what I'm going to do is watch how this unfolds. She was right off the farm, but she must have had a lot of dreams. She never was able to go to school, public school, beyond sixth grade because, you know, back in the old days, she was born in 1910. And, you know, they had to work on the coffee farm in Keopu, close to where Allison Onizuka grew up as well. And we're in the rocky fields. And, you know, I think they had a lot of time thinking about what life means and what it could be. They didn't have iPhones and busy looking up things on the iPhone. So they had plenty of time to kind of ponder. You know, one thing that I always wondered was she always told me that what she dreamed of becoming was that detective story of UK. He was supposed to be the very best detective.
Oh, Sherlock Holmes?
Sherlock Holmes. She said, I want to become a Sherlock Holmes. And so she must have had this mind that tried to solve these very complicated situations. And very interesting, because she said that so many times over the times that I remember. So you're talking about a coffee farmer, and for the few books that they had in school up till eighth grade, she ran across that, and, you know, that was one of her things that she wanted to do. So she had this ambition to become someone that can do something.
Well, she certainly did do something, and it was really unusual, I think, for a little teeny Kona coffee farmer woman and a Japanese woman in the late 60s, early 70s to actively lobby, you know, with the governor, Governor Burns, right?
Yes.
And make it clear that what she wanted to see was a park, an open space. As she's told me one time when I had the privilege to meet her, she used to be able to look down at that park from your house up there. She could see the kids playing.
She actually had a tremendous kind of an eyesight. We were talking about not too far below Mamalahoa Highway. And when we used to go fishing down past the old airport along the point, she said she could actually physically see the bamboo poles. And so, you know, I think her eyesight was extraordinary as well. And you know, she wasn't making it up. I mean, she truly saw our bamboo poles, because back in the old days you had the 20-foot bamboo poles trying to fish along the shore. But she said she could see us with the poles.
And she wanted to keep on seeing you and other kids down there. She didn't want to see industrial area shops and warehouses and stuff.
Well, you know, when the airport closed, and I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of about 1970, I guess it just like a light bulb went on. She said, well, this would be a great park for the people. She latched on to that idea, and she became really active and began to get involved with the political systems. She would get to know people locally at political elections and try to get things going for the Kona side. And the old airport park was one that caught on fire for her. And then she got to understand that if you want something happen in that kind of magnitude, you can't just do a local push. She knew that she had to go to Honolulu and meet up with the governor. And at that time, it was back in Governor Burns' days in 1970.
Well, obviously, she sort of infected you with the idea that to be a fully functioning member of the community, you have to get involved, and you have done that. And I'm grateful to her, and I think everybody should be grateful to your mother, Kiono Kunitake. Now, Walter Kunitake, the reason we're here today is that last week we heard from Arnold Hiura at the Hawaii Japanese Center in Hilo about the arrival of the Japanese into the state starting around 1868, and about the role of the Japanese in plantation work and wars and politics. If you'd like to hear that interview, you may do so online at kwxx.com or b97hawaii.com or wherever you get podcasts. Just look for Island Conversations. Now, Arnold noted that the initial contracts for the plantation workers were about 3 years, and after that, some did stay with plantations, some went to Japan, some went to California, but a lot of people stayed here, and a lot of people left the plantation. And I know that your family members came to work on a plantation, so I want to talk, Walter Kunitake, about what was their incentive to leave the plantation when they had that opportunity, and why did your family members and other family members come to the Kona side of the island?
Well, you know, plantation work, whether you came to Kauai or Maui or Honolulu or Big Island, it was a rough life. They came to the plantation work believing that they were coming to paradise and they would be able to work for a few years and then go home with a bag full of resources to share at home in Japan. But when they got here, they found out that this was a very rough life where the work was difficult. The pay was just enough to feed the family, pay for the laundry bill. That was it. There was nothing else left for them to take home. So essentially, when they left, they had this great anticipation of having a great time here and going home. But it didn't work out that way. So when they left Japan in their initial come over, they severed their families without realizing they severed from their families and came here and were never able to go back. So today, for instance, third, fourth, fifth generation people have to work really, really hard on Ancestry.com, et cetera, to basically find their roots. And many of them have not really gone back to even meet anybody that is remotely related to them in Japan. So it was a kind of a sad chapter for people to have this family line that they can rely on to say, okay, this is where I came from. I still have relatives that became songwriters or whatever. But nevertheless, you know, you do what you gotta do. So people came here and did the best they could. But when they were done with the sugar work...
Well, first let me just ask you, your family, what plantation did they come to when they first came?
My father's family came, according to one of my friends who's a researcher, came in 1886, and they came to the Big Island and out to the Kau side. And my mom's family came over for sugar work as well, and came into the general location for sugar work in Kau. In my mother's case, my mother was born in 1910. And so from 1910, the story that I heard from my mom is that when she was 3 months old, as you can imagine, the road system on the Big Island was almost just a trail. And so they horse and buggied with her mom and her older sister all the way to Kona, close to where Alison Onizuka grew up in Keopu, and took a couple days, and she was only 3 months old. And they came to an existing coffee farm, because from around that location, Keopu, it was too rocky for sugar to grow, although we had sugar in Kona. They actually came to an existing old house that was sitting on the Liliuokalani Trust property. And the old house still sits on that same Liliuokalani Trust property that's on that same Ahupua that goes all the way from Kailua. The old airport was once a Liliuokalani Trust property. And that, if you look at the Google map, you'll see that there's an Ahupua that goes all the way to the top of the mountain. And part of that Ahupua is where my grandparents settled in 1910, and then my parents, and then myself. So I grew up in a house that almost looks like Uchida Farm. And I grew up with the old bathtub with heated water from coffee sticks and so on. So I lived through that.
You know, Walter, you mentioned there were sugar plantations on the Kona side, but as I understand it, they weren't plantations by our definition of the very large company plantations.
Well, one of the reasons why the folks that came to Kona was when they left the Kau plantations, when their contracts were over, they were looking for something that gave them a little more freedom and independence. And coffee was one area where if they came to coffee, they could have their own farm and do their own thing and sell their own products independently. Sugar was actually another area. My dad, who was born in 1905, told me stories about when he was 14 years old. So that takes it to 1919. At 1919, he said that he and his dad worked at the sugar mill right up the hill from here.
And that would be the one on Hinaloli and Hualalai Road?
Yes, and there's still remnants. So I'm glad that whoever owns that property has not taken it out. So we need to figure out how we can still preserve it.
Well, it's a real important part of Kona history, I think. And the understanding that I have is that when you talk about people growing sugar, it was essentially just like a lot of the farmers ended up with 5-acre coffee farms. They may have ended up with 5 acres of sugar cane because that's what they were good at growing. And that's what that sugar mill was used for.
Yes. And, you know, when they came to Hawaii, they were pretty much farmers from southern prefectures of Japan. You know, the Fukuoka, Kumamoto, Yamaguchi, Hiroshima. So those were all the southern prefectures, and they were farmers at heart to begin with. And that's how when they came to Hawaii, they were very successful in doing sugar very well. And so to come to Kona in these rocky lands where we didn't have big patches of soil, deep soil land where you could mechanize, and Hamakua and other places had great properties. Kau had good lands, but not in Kona. Kona was rocky, hilly, and it could not be mechanized like the other sugar plantations. So it was pretty much all manual labor. My dad said that he worked at the sugar mill when he was 14 years old. That's 1919. He told me some stories about what it was like. He said, well, first of all, since they did not have all these machineries to haul the sugar harvested cane to the mill, they had this system. And by the way, the train track ran pretty much from right up the hill from here in Kailua all the way to Captain Cook, close to the Choice Mart out in that area. So there was a train track that ran all that distance. And I think it was, you know, at least 10, 11 miles long. And so how did they get the sugar grown up in the hill at 1,500 feet elevation down to where this train track was at the bottom of the hill? According to my dad, he said they had these so-called zip lines. And they had this cable that was anchored at the bottom and anchored at the top. People would manually harvest the cane and tie it in bundles. And they would hook this bundle of cane. And I'm just going to guess, since these were all manually handled, it probably wasn't more than 100 or 200 pounds big. They bailed it up and they hooked it onto this zip line and they said, go. And they just let it come down. And I'm thinking that, you know, that's a great distance that he has to come down on the zip line. No brakes, no nothing. It was just one free fall zip line.
So just by gravity.
Just by gravity. And at the bottom, there was this wall. And he said this thing would be coming down at, I don't know, 100 miles per hour. And this bale of sugar would just hit this bunker and just fly off the cable. And then they would then pick it up and then manually throw it into these train cars.
I had never heard that story before. I like that story. And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Conversations. I'm Sherry Bracken. Today we're talking with Walter Kunitake, a Kona coffee farmer who's sharing with us some of the information, some of the details about the folks who came to the Kona side of the island after their time in the plantation service was up. We're going to, in a minute, talk about the Japanese Cultural Center of Kona, the plans for that. Next Saturday, January 11th, there is a luncheon at Old Kona Airport that you can go to learn a little bit more about the project and just really have a fun lunch with entertainment by Kona Choral Society, Honoka'a Jazz Band, the Ka'ea Lions Halau, and a Japanese musical group. There's also going to be a really cool silent auction. To get your ticket to that, go online to KonaCulturalCenterOfKona.com, and you'll find out how to get your tickets. Walter has more information about the early Japanese arrivals, and then we will talk about his vision for the Japanese Cultural Center of Kona. But first, let's hear from our sponsor, KTA Superstores, one example of a family-owned business, Japanese family-owned business, that's been helping folks on our island for more than 100 years.
At KTA, local and fresh means you get the very best Hawaii Island has to offer. The grass-fed meats you find at KTA are raised without added hormones or antibiotics. Our seafood department is stocked with sustainable choices caught in local waters by local fishermen. KTA carries the largest selection of Hawaii Island homegrown produce. Our Mountain Apple brand is all local, so you know it's fresh and delicious. Local and fresh always tastes best at KTA.
Walter, I know that a lot of people came to the Kona side to farm coffee, and now I know that some came and farmed sugar. Any sense as to other occupations that the people engaged in who came to the Kona side of the island after working on the plantations, after their contracts were up?
Well, you know, right up in Hololoa, there were farmers that grew cotton, and it was an industry that took hold. And, you know, Kona being such a great fertile place where anything grows, they had cotton right up here in Hololoa.
And, you know, I remember Alfreda Fujita, who was very active with the Kona Coffee Festival, telling me how she had to take time off school to pick cotton, and she hated it.
Yeah, and I've heard stories from Alfreda as well, and she said coffee was not fun because at 3 o'clock they had to be in the field in the morning waiting for the sun to rise to get bright so they can start right away. Yeah, but beyond that, there was another industry, and that was the sisal industry. And I think this is where I think we need to share with the people of Kona and the world these industries. The sisal, some of you might know what the sisal industry is, but if you were to drive from Kailua going up to Palani Junction, on the right-hand side of Palani, a lot of it is on this Liliuokalani Trust, Ahupua. And you see this very tall pole with some leaves on the bottom, kind of a cactus-like. And on the top, there's a little flower that grows. Those posts were really good to make fence posts. So they harvested this long pole that could grow as high as 20 feet tall. It was a little bigger on the base. I'm going to guess that the base was about 6 inches big on the base. And as you get closer to the top, it may come down to maybe 3 or 4 inches. But you can make posts 6 feet long, and you can probably make 3 posts out of one plant. And besides that, they harvested the fibers from the leaves. And at the end of the leaves, there was this very sharp black thorn. If you ran into it, it was no fun. Okay, but getting the fibers are really one. I don't know anything about hemp fibers, but I think the sisal fibers worked out pretty well to make ropes and things.
There were also storekeepers. If anybody goes on the Mamalohoa Highway, you can see the remnants of, and even some of the stores still intact, like the Keaho store a little bit to the south. And of course, the Ellison Onizuka family, they had the Onizuka store. And there were other stores along the way.
Yes. You know, if you go back in time, you know, when did we have vehicles that was readily available to all the families? It was donkeys and walk feet for the most part. So to accommodate the needs of all these folks that lived pretty much from Kalawa all the way to Captain Cook and Honaunau and beyond, they had to have these little stores, because when people wanted to go and buy a loaf of bread, they had to walk to these little stores. So the distance of the stores were really close to each other. So there was the Matsumoto store up in Kalawa, and I'm sure there were more in between, but we know the famous Alice in Onizuka store. But not too far off is the Komo store, the Kei Komo store, which is probably only, what, 1,200 feet? If you keep going towards Hololoa, there was Okoyama store, and then there was the Harada store, and then there's the Nakamoto store, and there was a Mori store, and the Kawaharas had a little vegetable stand, a store along the highway, and then Paul's Place, we all know Paul's Place. If you keep on going, there's Nishino store, and, you know, these stores were all spaced apart where you could reach these stores by just walking. You know, if we had research done, like, how many stores were there from Kalawa to KA, I mean, it would be a large number. But they serviced the local community.
Walter Kunitake, one of the projects that you're involved with now is creating a Japanese cultural center for Kona. When we spoke recently with Arnold Hiura of the Hawaii Japanese Center in Hilo, he talked about some of the artifacts and some of the things that they do there. Talk about the Japanese Cultural Center of Kona as you envision it. First of all, why is one needed?
Kona is a beautiful place on the planet. We have all the nice weather, we have a nice slope, we have nice trade winds, we rarely get hit by disastrous storms, etc. And it's just a nice, attractive place. And the Japanese Cultural Center from a few years ago, you know, it just came to mind that we have a lot of people that's visiting Japan, because Japan is a beautiful place to go. You know, the food, safety, the good Shinkansen and bullet train and on and on. And we have a base of Japanese organizations, 5 prefectural clubs. You know, we have what we call the Okinawa Kenjinkai. So people of Okinawa ancestry would join together and socialize. So we have 5 of these prefectural clubs. We have the Kono Japanese Civic Association. So back about 60 years ago, when the Japanese started to settle down, they said, you know, let's go ahead and group together so we can share common songs and so on and so forth. So the Japanese community has steadily established themselves as being people of the community. So if that's the case, Kona being a beautiful place, people love Japan today, and why not? Why not build a beautiful Japanese cultural center for the world to participate in, where we can showcase not only what is unique to the Japanese culture, but also for how the Japanese immigrants that came to Kona to live a life which is kind of unique. For instance, Lauhala weaving. It was around prior to the Japanese immigrants coming, but when they came, almost every Japanese family knew how to weave Lauhala and make Lauhala baskets and Lauhala slippers, etc., etc.
Well, the Kimura Lauhala store that is right at the junction of Hualalai Road and Mamalahoa Highway, that's a great example. When you talk about the Japanese in Hawaii, you know, I went to the Japanese National Museum in Los Angeles with my mom, which was started by Senator Daniel Keanoe's wife, Irene. It's got several items in there that are actually Kona specific. So I would hope that the Japanese Cultural Center, as you envision it, would include items that are part of the cultural history of this side of the island.
You know, we have our hero, Alison Onizuka, and people all over the world sharing Alison's legacy. Rodney Ano, who was a veteran that lost his life at Vietnam. And, you know, as we were talking to Michelle Johnson, she kind of brought up her uncle's name, Toshitogo. Norman Sakata's brother, Toshitogo, was with Goldfinger, Kona boy.
What was the name of his character in Goldfinger? Was he Oddjob?
Oddjob, that's
yeah.
It.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, ooh, now we got to kind of reach to remember. But I think these are the things that we got to showcase, that we have some people that are world known
And interesting.
And from Kona, yeah.
Well, I also understand that you plan to have a Japanese garden.
Yes. You know, many of folks are going to Japan to see the beautiful Japanese gardens because it's such a beautiful, peaceful, artful garden. There are 300 Japanese gardens in North America. And the most famous one is the Portland Japanese Garden. And they are very successful in presenting a lot of the things that are authentic to a Japanese garden. We are reaching out to people and organizations and prefectures and officials to help build this Japanese Cultural Center. And the current plan that we have is about 24, 30 acres big, which would include lots of things. So obviously the Japanese garden is going to be very close to one that you would visit in Japan, with a ponds and tea house next to it and trees that are lined up very beautifully, like you see the black pine bonsai trees all over Japan, maybe 10 acres, a huge one. And so that is one of the significant display of the cultural center.
What other things do you envision being part of this Japanese cultural center?
You know, obviously you need kind of a gallery, a museum. We have a lot of artists in Kona that are actually world known, and we need to share some of their artwork in Kona. Besides that, you know, I think it would be really great to have all 47 prefectures display something that's unique to their prefecture. For instance, my wife and I, Charlene, went to visit Akita Prefecture, which is way up north. We met with the vice governor and also met with three cabinet people, and we have now a very close relationship with the Akita Prefecture officials there. But if we can get prefectures of Japan, 47 of them, to participate in this Japanese Cultural Center in any which way, so if they have a unique toro, or it's called a lantern, you know, we can have them donate and bring it here. They could bring over a tori, one of these bright vermilion. It has deep meaning to it, but for us, it's a beautiful presentation. And then maybe have a brief explanation as to what it really means. We can help educate people. Beyond that, we have these buildings. Besides the gallery, we have the ballroom, seating up to 750, 800 people. People that want to use it to have a birthday party, performance with a certified kitchen, that would be really nice. We would have a dojo for the martial arts of any kind. And, you know, we can have world competitions even in some of these martial arts with the dojo. A tea house with the tatami mat and so on, where we have the masters of tea ceremonies come and do rituals. A restaurant, a nice restaurant. Another one that is quite beautiful, I think, for Kona is a performing arts concert hall. How's that?
That sounds great.
I've been kind of in the farm too long, and I didn't realize there is this Kona Choral Society that is performing in Kona, and actually not only in Kona. They're going to different parts of the planet and performing. In Maui, there's a very beautiful concert hall, Maui Arts and Culture Center, a beautiful one. I think the performance that you could have in a beautiful concert hall where you can even have multi-layers of seating. I've been to one that we had 1,200 seats in one in the countryside in Japan, Tomiokaguma, and watch this, the top Enka Japanese singer perform for 2 hours. And so Charlene and I went there for two shows and were able to talk to this wonderful performing person, Shimazu Aya. And one day when we have this concert hall built, we'll have people from all over the world coming, the top performers.
One of the things that the Kona side of the island has lacked is a good place for top-notch musicians to perform. So they will go to Oahu, they'll go to Maui, to the Maui Arts and Cultural Center, but they don't come to Kona because we don't have a place that's acoustically appropriate and that has enough seating to make it worth their while. So all of this sounds good. But you know, the $64 million question, Walter Kunitake, is do you have the property to build the Japanese Cultural Center?
Well, you know, I think earlier I mentioned that we're looking at a project that will require somewhere in the neighborhood of 25, 30 acres. you know, when you look at the Kona landscape, and I have done a lot of research, and we have a team of people that are in the know about lands and property issues and so on. We're so lucky at this stage of this project that we have available properties in Kona from Makalei Golf Course all the way down to Napopo Junction. Very accessible from highways, and there's literally a lot of properties that's available for a project such as this. So if we were in a place like Oahu, it's impossible to even think that something like this could be done in Oahu because the space is all used up. And so we feel that the ingredients to a cultural center project like this is just perfect, because I also mentioned that Kona is a beautiful place, it's well known, our weather is great, we have beautiful slopes, people just love to visit here. So in a year, the number of visitors that come to the Big Island is 2 million people. And when I mentioned this project to our HVB guy, Ross Birch, he got really excited. He said, this is exactly the kind of thing that we should be working toward. About 2 million people visits the Big Island. 80% of them come to Kona. We are going to develop this cultural center so that it is very welcoming, warm, attractive, and must see.
So, Walter, the answer is no, you do not have property, but you are looking for property. Is that what I am to understand?
Yes, we have a land acquisition task force, and we're just beginning to talk to landowners to say, this is what we're looking at. And we were able to get some funds from the state of Hawaii, the Hawaii State Granting Aid Program, $75,000. The focus on that $75,000 was to get a master plan produced. And we were so blessed that we were able to convince Glenn Kimura, who has been one of the top planners in the state of Hawaii, who came here to do this project. Glenn Kimura just completed this master planning in December.
If people want to see the work that Glenn Kimura did in designing the conceptual plan for the Japanese Cultural Center, it's actually online at JapaneseCulturalCenterOfKona.com. Right, Walter?
That is correct. So now the Japanese Cultural Center of Kona, we have our website. The first thing that you see is this wonderful video rendition of this master plan. And then there's lots to learn about the project because the website is quite descriptive.
I know that you are not yet in a position to be doing major fundraising, because I know the goal is to have the property picked out before you do that, but people can go to an introductory luncheon next Saturday, January 11th, at Old Kona Airport. If you are interested in tickets, the information is at the website, JapaneseCulturalCenterOfKona.com. And Walter, at this point, are you accepting donations, just plain old donations?
Yes, we do not have the land, so we're not really embarking on a capital campaign fundraising, but yes, we had a golf tournament as a fundraiser on September 21, and we're now getting people to donate to the Cultural Center project, the event coming up on January 11th. If you go to the website, we do have a form on the website where you can actually make your donation, you can sponsor a table, you can buy tickets. If you go to that, you'll know exactly who the board of directors are. They're all the local folks, so you know these folks. But yes, we welcome any funds that you can share because, as you know, in any organization, no funds, no project.
Walter Kunitake, what would you like to say before we say aloha?
Well, you know, Sherry, my dad, who never traveled a lot in the world, he never went to Japan in his entire life, not even once. But as a second generation Japanese immigrant, he was very Japanesey. But he always said, Kona is the best place in the world. And I think he could feel what Kona was like, what Kona is like as compared to any place else on the planet. So, you know, I really appreciate you, Sherry, because you have been such an entity, a force to help Kona. And so for you to invite me to come here to share some of the stories of what the Japanese immigrants are all about and what this project is all about. I think it's so important that we support this because it brings people together. A Japanese garden will just be a place where people from all over the world can kind of meet each other and experience something that they never had before.
Walter Kunitake, thank you so much for being with us. Aloha.
Well, I thank you very much again, Sherry, and my word to the people of the Big Island and elsewhere. Thank you very much. We look forward to your support.
And my thanks for listening to Island Conversations. If you'd like to learn more about next Saturday, January 11th, luncheon at Old Kona Airport, doors open at 10, events go 11 to 2, a halau, the Kona Choral Society, Honoka Ahai Jazz Band, a Japanese Goto group, the kickoff luncheon for the Japanese Cultural Center of Kona. Information is online, JapaneseCulturalCenterOfKona.com, and you may get your tickets there. I'm Sherry Bracken. Until the next Island Conversations, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Conversations with Sherry Bracken, available anytime at KWXX.com. We welcome your feedback and suggestions at info@kwxx.com. Join us next week for another Island Conversations with Sherry Bracken, brought to you by KTA Superstores, where you're someone special every day since 1916.